You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWalkUp, flexible loans built for small businesses. Today, we are in Budapest.
Cozze citene, cozze, cozze vicine, nu spigudeci cora, nu spigudeci cora, cozze citene, cozze, cozze vicine.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're still in Budapest, Richard. The birthplace of Zsa-Zsa Gabor, of Harry Houdini, otherwise known as Erik Weiss, and of Ferenc Puskás, the great footballer who played for many years for Real Madrid and was one of the marvellous Magyars who hammered the English at Wembley in 1953.
Yeah.
I thought you'd like that, Richard.
That was Daniel that said that.
Very strangely.
Brilliant.
No cyclists in your list, Lionel.
Well, no, that will become kind of apparent in the episode. I don't really think you can put Laszlo Bodrogi in the same bracket as Zsa-Zsa Gabor, can you? Or Harry Houdini? Or Puskás?
I think so.
Not quite. It's a bit of a...
He was French anyway, Laszlo, as we'll discuss.
We should also probably introduce ourselves, chaps.
One thing... before we do introduce ourselves, it occurs to me you don't need to ask Napalm where are we, because we hear it at the start of the episode. Flavia tells us where we are, does she not?
Yeah, she does, but I just like to be told by Napalm, because that's a tradition on the Cycling Podcast going back to 2013.
She also doesn't go into the florid detail that I do. I've got a question for you.
Okay.
What links the great Hungarian footballer Ferenc Puskás and Peter Sagan?
Birthplace?
Do they both say why so serious?
No, Ferenc Puskás doesn't like indoor turbo trainer bike racing. No, Ferenc Puskás was in the Hungarian team that played in the World Cup final in the Vankdorf Stadium in Bern in 1954, which was where Peter Sagan won a stage of the Tour de France, pretty much in the road right outside the redeveloped stadium. There you go.
Cool.
Wow, what a link.
Amazing, isn't it?
That is. I'm Richard Moore. That was Lionel Burney. You'll be hearing lots of stuff like that from him over the next 3 weeks. And the other chap is Daniel Freib. Hello, fellas.
The other chap. That was very dismissive. Hello, chaps.
What's coming up in tonight's episode, Daniel?
Is this the bit that you usually do, Richard? I'm going to have to improvise. We're in Hungary, and we are going to be talking a lot about Hungary, Hungarian cycling, why it's such an anomaly, why it's always been a bit of a cycling backwater, why the only elite cycling alumnus we could think of was Laszlo Bodrogi, who spends most of his time in Besançon in France. We're going to be catching up with another, not a rider, but another well-known figure in Hungarian cycling. And we're also going to be speaking again to Mauro Vegni, the director of the Giro d'Italia, about whether, after the cancellation of this year's Grande Partenza in Hungary, whether the Giro might revisit Budapest and Hungary in the future.
We're also going to hear, though, from a couple of young Hungarians on the world tour whose progress suggests that status as a backwater may change, or at least be altered slightly. But before all that, can we have the tale of the tapa, please, Lionel?
Well, we can, Richard. Yes, we're in Budapest for the second night of our Giro. And Daniel, as race director, I've got to ask you, why have you reversed the stage that the original Giro, the real thing, was going to have, which was supposed to go from Budapest to Győr? Your stage goes in the opposite direction. It means we get two nights in Budapest, which is great. But
there we go.
Is that simple as that?
Yeah, these are the kinds of things that I factor in, Napalm. But I know you would have been looking forward to your Saturday night supper in Budapest after the prologue, and you'd have been looking daggers at me when I told you that we had to go 150 kilometers to the northeast. But the reason I've reversed the stage is that Richard mentioned the two young Hungarians riding in the World Tour now. One of them is Attila Valter from CCC. We're going to hear from him about various things, but one thing he told me was that the best climb in Hungary, in his opinion, was a climb called Dogo Boko, which is outside, just outside Budapest, and it's on the road from our stage start. So I put that little kicker in at the end. I like a climb at the end of a stage with a fast descent, and see who's there to contest the stage win.
Well, that climb you mentioned,
one for the Shark of Watford, I think that one.
The Shark of Watford, the Elephant of Watford, is my climbing style, as you well know. Well, let's cross over to the course. As you know, Richard and I have set off on our Giro riding on the RGT platform. Let's hear how we're getting on, because today's stage takes in that hill.
Well, that's stage two of our Giro completed. A few of us did a group ride this morning. That's Sunday morning. 31.4 kilometres mapped out for us today by VeloViewer. 500 metres elevation gain, most of it in the last 7 kilometres. Very tough climb up to the finish. I left Lionel behind on the climb to increase my lead on GC. I was surprised to see him start the ride with a cup of tea. I think he was expecting a leisurely pootle again today, but it was a tough one. And there are tougher days to come. But great fun, and great to see so many Cycling Podcast listeners out on the course with their pink jerseys. I got a few waves and thumbs up from some of you as you rode past me. Thank you, and see you tomorrow.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia. Brought to you by iWaka. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Yes, thank you very much indeed to our title sponsor, iWaka. iWaka are an award-winning finance company specializing in lending to small businesses. Founded in 2011, the company has issued more than £1 billion to companies ranging from startups to established businesses. They can lend between £1,000 and £250,000, and by making it quick and easy to apply for a loan and get a quick decision, it can be a more flexible option than approaching the big banks. iWaka is also into cycling, sponsoring the Kendal Cycle Club, based on the edge of the Lake District, and the Cycling Podcast, of course. For more information, go to iwaka.co.uk. And a special shout out to Dan Smith, who forged the link between the Cycling Podcast and iWaka. And from what I understand, Dan is trying to do our virtual Giro every day on RGT. He's joining us for each stage. That's what he's planning to do anyway. And I've said it now in the podcast, Dan, so you are committed.
Giro Dream Team with Giro Scognamiglio.
So, dear listeners, here we are with my special team for this ideal Giro d'Italia. By the way, you don't find any poor climber in my team. Why? Well, it's easy. Poor climbers love mountains. I hate mountains. So this marriage is simply not possible, and who cares about the overall ranking for this virtual pink jersey? So we could start with the first one, the captain, my soul sister, my mirror, Filippo Pozzato, the peacock of Sandrigo, as Daniel loves to say. He is my captain, the man I would like to be. I know it's impossible, but let me dream. Filippo won a lot of important cycling races in his career, as Sanremo, Etnius Blood, Ariel Beke, also on one stage in the Giro, in the real Giro, but as I told him once immediately after he missed a stage victory in the Giro, Filippo, it's better not to have won. Why ruins everything with a victory? You are the big thing, people. You himself are the victory.
Well, that was our old friend Ciro Scognamiglio there with the first in a semi-regular installment. He's picking his dream team, 8 riders and a DS.
Ciro's not going to be the team manager himself. I mean, that would be a recipe for disaster. Just kind of, he'd be driving behind the peloton and then just turn off halfway through the stage and just drive off towards the beach.
who would have thought that Filippo Pozzato would be in his dream team? I mean, I'm blown away by that already. The first big upset of this Giro, I think. The other thing we're talking about today, as well as Giro's dream team, is Hungarian cycling. I mean, we've tackled the course now, Daniel. Thanks for that. But we thought we'd sort of try to sort of pull back the curtain a bit on the Iron Curtain, a bit of a backwater in terms of cycling. I mean, the Giro going there was probably the biggest thing to happen in a cycling sense to Hungary ever. And that may be about to change because you spoke to a couple of young riders who are emerging and obviously very talented. But in your various conversations with people, have you managed to get to grips with why Hungary hasn't produced really any star riders over the years?
It's a strange one, Rich, and just to underline that, how much of a backwater it's been. Hungary was behind the Iron Curtain after the Second World War, and the big race, the Tour de France of the East, was the peace race, and no Hungarian ever won the peace race or finished on the podium or even won a stage, despite the fact that numerous Hungarians did take part in that. And, you know, moving forward to more recent times, Laszlo Bodrogi, we mentioned, he represented Hungary throughout his career, and he was at MAPE, very highly thought of. I remember seeing him in his first Paris-Roubaix, thinking this guy is going to be a Paris-Roubaix champion. He was very adept on the cobbles, or he looked it for certainly part of his debut race, but never really fulfilled or delivered on that promise. Was a good time trialist, multiple national champion, but he is by far the best Hungarian cyclist we've seen to date. And why have they struggled so much? I mean, just going back when they were under communism, it sort of semi-seriously referred to as goulash communism, the brand of communism that the Hungarians lived under, and that was a sort of diluted, watered down, less severe form of communism than prevailed in countries like East Germany and the Soviet Union. And the Hungarians also didn't use sport for propaganda in nearly the same way that the East Germans or the Soviets did. There isn't the same evidence of a statewide doping system of the same dimensions as there was in those countries. So I think it's a combination of those factors. The other thing is that Hungary itself generally is isolated in one very important way in Europe, and that's the language. Hungarian is one of the most difficult languages in the world to learn, and it's not related to any other European language.
But Drogi, I mean, you say he was a talented young rider. He was in that MAPE squad, the development squad that was put together in 2000. Filippo Pozzato was one of his contemporaries, so was Fabian Cancellara, and he won a silver medal in the World Time Trial Championships in 2007 behind Cancellara. But you're right, he was, I guess, as much French as Hungarian. We moved to France as a teenager, I think, didn't he? His father,
I think his dad was a surgeon, or his dad was quite a well thought of, he might have been a cardiologist or some kind of doctor or surgeon.
Oh, I hope he knew the difference. Yeah, but the family moved from Hungary to France, and Bodrogi has, I guess, dual citizenship, certainly. But he always represented Hungary, didn't he, in the World Championships? But yeah, you say, a good time trialist. I remember going to the Tour de l'Avenir one year, and he was in the yellow jersey, and kind of impenetrable, really, because even the people on the MAPE team didn't know a great deal about him. And at the time, I don't think he spoke English, and I certainly didn't speak Hungarian or French properly.
I mean, one of the issues that raises for any young riders of any promise at all is, how on earth do they get noticed? How do they turn professional? Is, you know, what's the pathway from Hungarian cycling to a professional contract, especially one at the World Tour? And I suppose it's testament to their talent and their promise that there are two young riders, they're both 21, in the World Tour this year, one with CCC, one with Mitchelton Scott, and you tracked them down and spoke to them, Daniel.
I did, Rich. I mean, the same thing occurred to me. What is the path? How did these guys get there? I mean, there has been no Pied Piper, really, in Hungarian cycling. No one for them to aspire to emulate, apart from Bodrogi. And just in Hungarian sport in general, I mean, over the last 10 or 15 years, there haven't been that many international sporting superstars. Probably the biggest one in recent memories, Christina Egazeghi, who's one of the best swimmers of all time. I think she won 3 Olympic gold medals, was a backstroker mainly. But yeah, in cycling, there's not been an awful lot. So I spoke to Attila Valter and Barnabas Peak about how they made it into the World Tour.
I was lucky because my father is also a cyclist and I raised by him, and then I joined the club. He's the coach of the club in my home city, and then it was not a big question. When he was riding a bike, when he was racing, it was much more popular back then, like 25 years ago. He was scouted in the elementary school, and we had one velodrome in Budapest, and then he go to the velodrome, he was racing there, and he was racing also in the road. And there was a bigger, much bigger peloton. You know, there was like, I think 100 person was riding like professional in Hungary. But then it just doesn't continue, you know. And now when we start a Hungarian race, it's like 20 riders or something. So back then it was more popular and he just liked it. But maybe we're going out of this period, and then I think now more and more kids started cycling, and you know, it was a few years ago, I think almost 10, when we see last riders in the World Tour, and now we already 2 riders in the World Tour from Hungary, and I think will be more and more. You know, yesterday I stopped to ask a policeman about the lockdown, because we don't have yet a lockdown, and I told him I have to go out because this is my job, and he asked my name, and I told him my name, and he said, I remember you from Tour of Hungary last year, so I will let you go. So this was really shocking that the policemen know about the race and about me. So I think it's getting really popular in the country. I started with the mountain bike, and I was not even looking on the road race. I of course know all the big races, but I never watched it fully. I mean, when I was 10, 12 years old, when I was really young. I watched the mountain bike, the World Cups. I watched the Absalon and Nino Schurter, more of the mountain bike riders. And I also raced on the mountain bike, going for other countries to compete. And then that was my main goal, to be a good mountain biker. But I had to realize that even if I be around top 20, top 10 in the world, which is, I think, extremely hard, almost like to be top 10 in the road, I think it's almost the same. Of course, there are less riders, but still to be the top 10 in the Olympics or something like this is extremely hard in a mountain bike. And then your salary and your payment is way lower than if you race on the road. And also I think it's even harder to make a living out of mountain bike. So I start to look on the road, and after I did my first races on the road, only that time after I start to watch the races. I already did some racing in under 17, I think, but I'm not sure. But for sure in junior, I was already did a few World Cups and the Nationals, but I had like 5 race days on the road or 4. And then in the under, there was one continental team in Hungary, and I was doing part-time mountain bike and part-time road with this team. So I was thinking to be like something like Mathieu van der Poel. You know, I still wanted to do mountain bike because it's fun. It's much better, I think, to the head, I was told. But after all, I realized that I still really love the road. Your head gets used to the long endurance rides and to the big work. And then after I had the offer from CCC Development, there was not a question that I should focus on the road, because maybe this is something that I have even more future. I have even more chance to show myself on the road. As I know, they saw me on the Tour of Slovakia. There was it was in 2018, and there was also Quickstep and a few other World Tour teams, and also CCC was there with their Pro Continental teams back then. And there was an uphill finish, and I finished behind Alaphilippe and Ben Hermans on the 3rd place. And I was not even know what I'm doing here on the road with big names. And then I think that was the reason, but they said they checked me, and they saw that I had some results, but you know, they don't know about these results. You know, if there is some victories, they don't know if that's really count a victory or that's just some small races.
I don't see myself as a like a Hungarian rider or anything. Like, obviously I am, but I don't see myself any different to the other ones in my team. But if I have to say something, yeah, we were in the east part of Europe after war period until 1989. And yeah, things been different. And since that, technology just doesn't reach so far back here. Like, it takes more time. And it's very easy to just be lazy and make excuses and don't work hard enough to make it. But if you work hard enough, then you can reach a top level. And I think it's just the mentality of Hungarian people to always complain about the government, about the laws, about everything. And yeah, that's not the way to make it to the top. I was rowing until 2014, from around 2009. And I just stopped because I didn't want to do it anymore. And I watched Froome's performance in the Vuelta that year, 2014, and I just got hooked. I bought a bike and then started to ride, and I'm doing that since. My training mates, when I was rowing, we watched the Vuelta together, and they were rooting for Contador, and I was rooting for Froome just because, just to do the opposite what they said. And yeah, Froome was the underdog that year because he broke his arm, I think, in the Tour de France as the defending champion. So yeah, nobody really thought that he could do it. And I can really relate to that, like, underrated situation. And I was really glad that he made a good tour that year. I mean, Vuelta that year. And yeah, it just was appealing to me. I have two sisters and one brother. My dad is a computer scientist, I would say. My mother is an accountant. Like, accountant is probably not the right word. She handles taxes of companies. And yeah, not really like a sporting background, but I always used to be pretty active when I was young. And I've done sports since I was a kid. And yeah, I just always wanted to be the best, I guess. That's why, yeah, I switched some sports. I started with football, then rowing, and then cycling now. I discovered it from TV, as I said. And then after, I was riding for some Hungarian clubs for a couple of years. And then the first big one was, I think, the World Cycling Center in 2017 and 2018 also. 2017 was my first under 23 year, and I won, I think, one UCI race, and I was second in the Tour of Hungary, so it was a pretty good start. And then the next year I got the stagiaireship with Quickstep, also went to training camp with them, so yeah, I started to believe that I could be there one day. And then SEG was really a good year for me. They were really professional, also the agency and also the team. I won a stage in Normandy. That was a pretty sweet memory. Still a pretty sweet memory for me. And after that, just I think a couple of weeks after my win, my agent came to me with the offer from Michelton, and it was a great offer. And I always fancied the team. So, and then I think at the Baby Giro, I already signed the contract. And then since that, it's been like this.
Well, we heard there from Payak and Attila, if that's the correct way to refer to them, Daniel, because there's a bit of confusion in Hungary about, or should I say, Freeb.
There's probably not confusion in Hungary about how
no,
to
maybe not. Okay, well, there's a bit of confusion for us with Hungarian names.
Well, Freeb. There was for me, and I'm none the wiser, really, having spoken to Attila, because he suggested that you could call him what I wanted. It was either Walter Attila or Attila Walter. It was all the same to him.
Well, we'll get to know, won't we? The question, I suppose, is
Walter.
Are we looking...
Sorry, Rich. Walter, yeah. Of course, is the name of a ski resort in Catalonia where the Volta Catalunya often finishes. Walter 2000.
No connection.
I don't
there,
think
though.
So. Not yet. Not yet. There
Not
might be
yet.
One day.
Well, are we looking here at the, you know, we know what's happened in Slovenia with this kind of generation of Slovenian cyclists. Are they the Pog and Rog of you know, 5 or 6 years down the line?
Well, I'll tell you what, before we go any further, should we hear from Barnabas Pejac on Pogacar, who he often came up against in the under-23 category?
Yeah, I raced against him a lot in the juniors especially. He's an excellent rider. He's a much, much better rider than me at the same age. Like, we are the same age, so he's developed very well. You could see that last year in the Vuelta that he's already an elite professional rider. And I only beat him because there was no hilltop finish in the race. There was a prologue where I beat him, and then there was one stage where there were crashes and I was just positioning myself a bit better, and then he got some seconds there. And the Helios stage, it was a climb and then downhill, and he attacked for the KOM. He dropped us for like 20-25 seconds, and then we just got him in the descent because he was alone, so it was not really suited for him. That's why I could beat him. But it turns out that now it's a big achievement to be better than him, but I wouldn't hold it against him, really, because I know that it was a bit of a special situation. I mean, after the stage where he attacked the for the KOM and where we caught him later, I texted him after that. I think he might remember that. I texted him, bro, you will win the Tour of France one day. Maybe in a couple of years he will win, because he's really, really good. And yeah, you could already tell back then that he was going to be something big.
Well, that was Pejac versus Pog. How about Pejac versus Attila?
Well, that's a good question, Rich. As far as their riding characteristics are concerned, Attila is more of a climber. And in fact, he showed pretty well already in 2020 in the few races he did before racing stopped due to the coronavirus crisis. And Pejac is kind of a punchy rider. He sort of suggested to me that he was a bit of a hybrid, a Thomas de Gendt, Daryl Impey hybrid. You know, he said he didn't want to big himself up, that obviously he's not that good yet, but one day he might be. So yeah, it's interesting, and you know, it would be fantastic for the Hungarians if these two did go on to have great careers and presumably develop some kind of rivalry. I thought they might have already, you know, had years of some ding-dongs between them, that they'd been going up against each other, a bit like Kwiatkowski and Sagan did, although they were from different countries. They raced against each other a lot as juniors. Not the case here, mainly because Attila was predominantly a mountain biker until a couple of years ago. But nonetheless, I was keen to hear what they both make of each other. First, we're going to hear from Attila again, and then Barnabas Pejac.
As I said, I came quite late to the road, and I did a few World Cups. I did General Patton in Luxembourg, and I did one more quite big race in Switzerland, and the World Championship, and that's all. So all the other races I was doing on the mountain bike, and Barnabas was already doing it on the road, more races on the road, more smaller junior races. So we haven't raced so much. And after we joined different teams, we have always different seasons, different races. So I was, for example, last year I was going more to the Eastern Europe with the Poland, Hungary, Romania. And as he was in the SEG racing, he was going more to the Netherlands and you know, stuff on the West. So we don't have a big rivalization, but of course he is a rider who is really hard to beat. He can sprint, he can climb, he can do a lot of stuff. So in a race in Hungary, it's really, really hard to get rid of him. I hope this year we will also have a race for the champion's jersey, and then we will see. If it's hilly, it's better for me. If it's flat, then he have a huge chance, because I think he is one of the best sprinters in the country now.
I wouldn't call him either one. Neither an enemy, neither like a best friend. He's a great rider. Like, I raced against him and also last year with him a lot, and he's an excellent rider. But I can also I wouldn't want to criticize him, because I don't know him that very well. But I feel like he has to be careful about the image that he has about himself in his head, because how I feel in this part, if you are not ready to give yourself or your services for your teammates, then you don't really make it. And I feel like he lacks a little bit in that department. But other than that, he's a good guy and he's an excellent rider, very strong rider.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, interrupting our Giro coverage to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Beer 52. And our friends at Beer 52 have an offer, 8 excellent craft beers for just £5. All you need to do is go to beer52.com/cycle and pay the £5 and you'll get a case of 8 globally sourced, fresh as they can be, craft beers delivered right to your doorstep. Now, what I like about being a Beer 52 club member is that you get a different case of beer each month and you can tailor the beers that you have in the selection too. So as the weather has warmed up and the evenings have got longer, I've swapped out the sort of heavier stouts and IPAs for the crisper lagers. And it's been very nice to have a case of Beer 52's craft beer arrive on the doorstep once a month or so. If you do change your mind about being a Beer 52 club member, you can pause or cancel your account at any time. In each case, you'll also get a copy of the award-winning craft beer magazine Ferment and a tasty snack. So just go to beer52.com/cycle. That's beer52.com/cycle to get your first case of 8 beers for £5. Now, I'll tell you what would go very nicely with a beer right now.
Il ristorante.
A San Francisco.
The dish that we know is goulash in this country, which more properly apparently is pronounced guyesh, although I'm very prepared to be corrected on that one, is actually not the dish that you will find under that name in Hungary. So in Hungary, guyesh refers to quite a thin beef soup. And the name actually means cowboy. And the idea is, a bit like chili con carne, it's a dish that sort of herders would have eaten when they're out on the vast Hungarian plains that we would have seen people cycling through. And so it's quite a simple dish, as that would suggest. There's no culinary fireworks here. And it is, to be honest, although the Hungarians make quite a big deal of how it's different from the thing that we think of as goulash, actually the two dishes, goulash and what Hungarians call pakolt, which is almost certainly pronounced wrong, are actually quite similar. And the difference between what the Hungarians think of as goulash and we think of as goulash is just basically a volume of liquid. So they're both beef dishes and they both start with onions, and you cook your onions down in quite a lot of fat, preferably maybe some lard. You don't want to brown them, you just need them to be nice and sweet and soft. And then you add the magic ingredient in both dishes, which is paprika, and you cannot have too much paprika in a goulash.
I've sauteed the onions, I've browned the beef, I've added the garlic and the caraway seeds, which will add a little hint of aniseed. Now time to take it off the heat and add the paprika. Can you give an honest assessment of my attempt at goulash?
Okay.
Oh dear, it's going to be that bad.
It's not. This isn't really fair because I didn't taste the goulash, and we'll say that a picture speaks 1,000 words. But I think actually some of the best food is often the least attractive food. But it's not that yours looked bad. It had a really good colour, lovely sort of paprika hue. So it wasn't. It can be very brown goulash. So you scored points for the colour, and it had that kind of correct soupy consistency. Only thing was, and I think this is probably quite authentic, I've not been to Hungary, but if tourist trap restaurants in Hungary are anything like the rest of the world, I feel like the fact that you went very heavy on the potatoes and dumplings, and I could see about 3 little bits of beef sticking up, and that probably made it quite authentic. I did zoom in just to really give this a bit of scientific rigour, and I don't know, was that beef a little bit chewy? Looked like it might have been a bit sort of hard on the old molars, but yeah, I think it was probably. I'm sure it was delicious. I would have added. You were very parsimonious. I would have added a big dollop of sour cream in there. But I guess you're probably going for the healthy sort of keeping you down to a racing weight. So yeah, good effort.
Well, there we go, chaps. Goulash is a soup, not a stew. I think we can all agree it looks absolutely delicious with the little dumplings in there. Felicity was, she went gently on me for the first dish of the Giro. A little challenge for people. I know this will absolutely delight Daniel. Over the course of the Giro, if you would like to cook your favourite Italian dish and post a picture of it on Twitter, copy us in at cycling underscore podcast. Felicity and I will be the judges of what looks best. I'm looking for a lot of pineapple on pizza. anything that winds Daniel up, really. But I really enjoyed making the goulash, and as I said, you know, it was a fairly austere dish. I think lots of paprika also needs to be counterbalanced with a bit of heat, and that was kind of absent. So I get Daniel's mention of kind of goulash communism, a sort of watered down version of something that really could have packed a bit of a punch. But there we go. I was looking forward to some goulash in Hungary. Hopefully we'll get a chance to have a dish of it at some point in the future. But getting back to Hungarian cycling, the man who has really made the most headlines, the Hungarian who's made the most headlines in cycling, is not actually a professional rider at all, is he, Daniel? And yet the headlines and the stories have attracted a lot of comment and have been pretty controversial.
Well, yes, Napalm, we became very familiar with a gentleman called István Vayas, also known as Stefano, also used an Italian name sometimes. Spent a bit of time in that country, I think. We became familiar with him, particularly in 2016. There was a series of stories about Vayas and his engineering work, and he was someone who'd been producing motors for bikes. I think most of them were small motors that went into the electric motors that went into the bottom bracket of bikes. And around about that time, there were a couple of very high profile documentaries made, one on French television and another one on the 60 Minutes, or by 60 Minutes in the US. And Vayas featured heavily in both of them. And the suggestion was that he had either been helping professional racers to cheat with motors, or he had knowledge of ways in which they were cheating with other people's motors. I think most of us remember the allegations, and as I said, caused a bit of a storm at the time. They really, that sort of flurry of publicity or flurry of attention for that issue led to the UCI introducing their tablet, their infamous tablet testing for motors in bikes. But the question is, where's Vayas now? Where did he get to, chaps? Anyone know? Anyone seen him, heard from him in the last couple of years?
Well, he's got a bit quiet, Daniel. We haven't heard a great deal from him. Maybe he stopped making his motors for the professional peloton.
Well, Napalm, it's funny you should ask. In fact, it was me that asked where he's got to, because he had sort of reappeared in the small print of on some cycling news websites over the last couple of years, in connection with what was going to be a team called E-Powers Factory Racing. They were supposed to maybe even ride the Giro d'Italia. They were going to be Hungarian registered, They were signing up some fairly high-profile riders, or supposedly doing that, including Davide Rebellin, from whom I got István Vayas' phone number the other day.
Hello.
Stefano? István?
Yes.
Hi, Stefano. My name's Daniel Freeba. I'm an English journalist. I'm calling from London. Am I disturbing you? Stefano, obviously we heard a lot from you 3 or 4 years ago about your e-bikes, how effective they were, how small the motors were, how light they were. But I imagine the technology has advanced even more over the last 3 or 4 years. Is that the case?
No, you know, for what they're supposed to use is the development of the power. The power is already too much since 20 years, you know, the power, you don't need a lot of power to make difference. The main property of this kind of system is to didn't see, didn't hear, and take only assistance when you really need for that. So it's not the point of view of engineering, is not a big issue to using for racing this kind of technology. What I saw now on the market is like Shimano is starting to understand the concept of this kind of e-bikes, because using the heavy and the usual e-bikes which is on the market today, I think there is not too much sense for people who like to make the sport like training, because it's too heavy. That bike is like a motorbike, 13, 14, 15, 20, 22 kilos. That's not a bike, it's a motorbike. The bike which you can use in racing in electric field is only, I think, is only bikes which has less than 10 kilos of weight. If you have over 10 kilos, it's starting to become a motorbike.
And what is your impression, your estimation, Stefano, of how many people are using these bikes to cheat in race?
This I can't tell you, because, you know, there is Vivax, the Austrian producers. They sold, I think, over 15,000 kits during the years. I can't predict how many people using for the race, because just with a small modification, you can use that kind of engine for using for challenge with the other racers. For me, it's a problem. There is not a real control for stack them, to stop them. we was not able to start in the world championships of the first electric mountain bike world championships. You know why? Because we're not using the same engine like they're using everybody. So our bike was only 12 kilo. The other bikes was like 18, 20 kilos. And they was not allowed to using our bikes because they said, no, this bike is not conforming by the law. But it's bullshit, because the only bike which is conforming by the law, we make an inspection even in Giro d'Italia. It was only our bikes, because our engine is really a small engine, less than 250 watts of power. And the other bike has 400, 500, 800, 1000 watts of power of the engine. And they was allowed to start. We was refusing to be started. They said, okay, Stefano, you can start if you're using Shimano or Bosch or something.
Do you think the UCI was upset with some of the things you said and some of the publicity you got a few years ago? Is that the issue, maybe?
I think so, maybe. I help with them always. They asking to help, I help with them. And when we just wanted to make a competition, a legal official competition, they were refusing, because they said, no, your bike is too... Because they know if we're using our bikes, we go to win, because our bike is 5, 6, 7, 8 kilos less than the others, the concurrents. This is the problem. Today, there is not a real willing even to start, because this... tablet, you know, the tablet, the X-ray is all bullshit. So nobody can. Did you ever seen any journalist, any kind of people who was able to take a place on the control when they made any control in this race? I didn't hear nobody. If a journalist or somebody could be stay in the tent to check when they check the bikes.
If you were the UCI, what kind of testing would you be doing? Would you be taking every bike apart after every race?
Yes, but it's very easy, you know. It's very easy and very simple. But you know, nobody when it was proposed to them to make some real control, they said they are more clever to do that. Okay, let's do it. But nobody see any controls.
So when you watch professional bike racing, are you suspicious?
No, actually, I didn't follow this kind of race, but. You know, you can see if they use engine or not. I think it's very easy to detect. Just enough to make some vertical ascension calculation, and you will understand that it's something which is not real. Because between doping and the technological doping, there is a lot of differences. So you can't earning extra watt on the flat. You can't tell what's happening, but on the hill, it's possible to tell if there is something which is suspicious or not.
And what about your plans to launch an elite e-Powers factory team, obviously with non-motorized bikes? It didn't come to fruition this year, but could it still in future?
We don't know, because if the government, like in other countries, like in Kazakhstan or like in the Emirates, they can support the team, we can be interesting to supply them with our bikes without engine. Because, you know, people, professional like David Rebellion, he was our official for the brand ambassador, yes. He wanted to ride with our bike without engine, because he understands the bike quality is very high. We asked him from the UCI the stamp, you know, the etiquette in the race. They approve it, and a lot of people are interested to buy it for racing with this bike without engine.
Interesting to hear from the man himself, Daniel. I'm always suspicious of people who go by different names, especially one and a Hungarian name and an Italian name. This is highly irregular stuff.
What order do they go in? Is it Vajas Istvan Stefano? Stefano Vajas Istvan? What
depends.
Is it? Istvan, of course. Istvan is a kind of translation of Stefano, or the other way around.
Depends who he's selling his bikes to, I guess. But just to go back to some of the allegations that were made, particularly by the 60 Minutes show, Vajas said that he had basically made a motor and sold it as early as 1998 to an anonymous buyer for $2 million on the condition that he didn't speak about the motors or make any new ones and sell them for a period of 10 years. Now, we've never got to the bottom of all of these stories, have we? We still don't know, you know, whether motors were definitively used in events or not. But for a period of a couple of years, this was a real hot issue, and it has gone away a little bit. And it's interesting, you know, to hear that the man himself doesn't think that the UCI's tablet detection protocol is really policing the system, you know, policing things particularly well.
Well, and that his recommendation for the UCI, which according to Vajas they've ignored thus far, is that the bikes be dismantled every day in front of, among others, a sort of jury of journalists. Can you imagine, you know, being sort of frog marched off somewhere behind the podium at the end of every stage, a group of us, and watching, I don't know, Peter Sagan's bike being taken apart?
I don't know really where to begin with this. It's a whole topic, isn't it? It blew up really around about 2010, didn't it? The story that, or the claims that some riders were using motors, and they introduced the first test in time for the Tour de France that year in Rotterdam. I remember the first watching with some kind of amazement at some of the early tests that were being done on bikes, which seemed to involve just taking the saddles out and tipping the bike upside down, but that might be unfair. But he did say, Vajas, that he doesn't really follow professional cycling, he seemed to say, but also that he can tell from watching a performance whether someone's using a motor or not. There seemed to me to be an apparent contradiction in those two claims.
Yeah, I think you're right, Rich. Although, you know, it is quite, he does make quite a compelling case, quite a persuasive case for, the possibility of using a motor and it not being detected. I mean, his motors are incredibly light. He's sure that they wouldn't be detected unless you did take the bike apart. So, you know, the question is the mentality, is the desire to do that ingrained in the current peloton to cheat in that fashion? I mean, we hope not.
We've talked about this a lot before, particularly when this was the hot story. And there really is, you know, the controversy about doping using banned substances is one thing, but actually cheating using a motor is a whole other level, really, isn't it? I mean, it would absolutely destroy the credibility of the sport. And I suppose that was one of the things about this period when it was one of the hot topics. Somebody as high profile as Greg LeMond giving credence to the allegations and the rumours, and so it never really went away, although it has died down a bit. But of course now there is an e-Giro d'Italia anyway, and one of the more curious sights over the last couple of years at the Giro has been to see this peloton of riders come speeding past. I know the bikes are capped at a certain speed, but the advantage seems to be that you can reach that speed on the climbs. And we parked up one day waiting to get into the finish straight so we could go round to the press room, and the little e-peloton came round the corner. They were absolutely flying up the hill, and I thought, well, there's hope for me yet.
Which team won the Giro last year?
I don't know, Daniel.
Mr. Vallès's team.
Mr. Vallès's team.
Goodness
no
me.
No joke. Even that was contentious. Vallès explained to me that the organisers didn't want his team to take part because they had a motor that was so superior to the others that there was some issue with not being able to charge the battery or being able to charge the battery. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, they did win that Giro d'Italia last year. E-Giro d'Italia.
Cheating in e-cycling. I mean, how much further can this rabbit hole go? How much deeper?
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Big thanks to our longest standing sponsors, Science in Sport, for their continued support of the Cycling Podcast. And if you want to stock up on your Science and Sport products, go to scienceandsport.com and enter the code SISCP25. If you're riding our Giro with us on RGT, then you may be wanting to stock up on, well, there's some pretty brutal stages ahead, so you might need some proper energy bars and energy bakes, as well as some of the hydration products that Science and Sport do as well.
My name is Bernd Hambus, and I am a freelance photographer. And I moved to London in 2009 from Hungary, where I was born and I grew up and lived and worked until I was about 30. The thing is, in Hungary, if you're a cyclist, big things don't really happen to you. Like, you know, we don't have, you know, famous cyclists. So when you follow cycling, your experience is that, you know, great things happen to other nations. And so you just kind of don't even, you know, dream of having a big race in Hungary or someone like a Hungarian rider doing well in a big race. That's why when at the Cyclocross World Championships in the under 23 women's category, a Hungarian rider became second. That was for me a very emotional thing because, you know, I just never see anybody from Hungary doing that well in a bike race. And kind of similarly, when I learned that the Giro would start from Hungary, I was really, really proud because suddenly something big would start from my home country, and, you know, I would go home and, you know, stay with my parents as always, but then the Giro would be there as well. So that was the very kind of exciting part. But then, you know, there's always the question of money, where is the money coming from? And, you know, the current regime is very keen on sports washing. So, you know, is that seven or nine million euros that been spent somewhere else, some, you know, better? I mean, it's still nothing compared to the amount of money they're spending on a Giro. It's nothing compared to the amount of money that they're spending on stadiums, like football stadiums. So it's, in a way, it's just a drop in the ocean. But it's still, I have a bit of a conflict that, you know, is this me supporting the current regime if I'm kind of happy for this race? So it's, I have mixed feelings because of that.
Well, that was our colleague Balint Hamvas, a Hungarian journalist based here in the UK, who obviously was delighted that the Giro was going to go to Budapest and Hungary, but also had some mixed feelings and some misgivings about it as well, raising the possibility or suggesting that it was, you know, there was some kind of sports washing going on. Obviously, a very controversial government in place in Hungary, something that we would have probably got into a little bit more had we actually physically gone. But Viktor Orban in charge in Hungary leads a very kind of controversial regime, doesn't he? And well, that charge is one that we've become quite familiar with, of countries and governments using sport and major sporting events to sports wash their reputations.
No doubt, though, that for the Hungarian people and the people of Budapest, it would have been a big party, and it would have meant a lot to the cyclists in Budapest and in Hungary, where the Giro was going to be visiting. And, well, shall we hear from Attila Valter, or Valter Attila, on what it meant to his family to think of the Giro visiting their home country?
Wow, the Giro is coming here. And it was, you know, a big moment. I was with my father and also my grandfather watched it, and I saw the tears in their eyes. It was a really huge moment that we haven't even organized it yet, but we had the chance, and this is something big for the country, for the cyclists. And they worked in the cycling for so long, and I think this is the biggest thing they ever witnessed. So we have a great country, we have many things to show. Budapest is beautiful, and the other cities is also really nice. We can make a really good Grande Partenza.
Well, I suppose the big question is whether, with this year's race having been postponed and the revised Giro that's planned for October not starting in Hungary, whether a future Giro will go to Hungary for a Grande Partenza. What are the chances, Daniel? And I think you spoke to a man who may know.
It is a good question, Rich. Obviously, we don't know what kind of world we're sort of all going to wake up to, and in our respective countries, and what sort of economic conditions we're going to find when this is all over. And I guess that will heavily influence whether the Giro can go back to, or can go to Hungary. Anyway, I decided to ask the Giro director himself, Mauro Vegni, precisely that question.
Noi abbiamo fatto insieme una scelta nel...
Look, we made a choice together to postpone this year because it's obvious that a government which has decided to make an investment to promote a territory, a culture, and to try to attract tourists is a lot less focused on that at a time like this. So we all agreed that we'd reconsider it for 2021. Clearly, next year has not been our number one priority recently either, but we hope that we can have those conversations when the current crisis has been resolved or is heading in that direction. We, of course, already had other options for 2021. In fact, more than options, we had agreements. So when the time's right, there'll have to be three parties around the table to find a solution to this problem, which is no one's fault.
In qualche modo sistemata, io credo che in questo momento potremmo ricominciare a parlare...
Amarcord, I remember.
There is something about Mussolini.
Yeah, but...
I'm not. I'm against Mussolini, but I will say to you what he make here. He make one of the greatest stadium in Italy. The stadium of Dallara. He was is still there. Built by Mussolini. But here, the Bologna, if you want to ask to me what is Bologna, about politics, Bologna, she's the freedom. Because about Bologna is Catholic, fascist, communist, and freedom. And the first and the last is freedom.
Remember that, chaps? I can see
unforgettable.
I can see a theme developing in our Amarcord entries. Boozy dinners or alcohol is unfortunately usually involved. In the absence of a wine of the day today, which is coming tomorrow.
That was a very enjoyable meal, though, with your parents were there as well, Daniel.
Well, we should say, shouldn't we, it was Bologna a year ago, exactly a year ago. Was it the night of the first stage at La Drogheria, or the night before in Bologna?
It was the first night. It was the Friday night.
And that was
I remember it because it was the occasion upon which I was presented with a Bolognese sauce piled on top of the pasta. I don't know if you remember that, Daniel. You told me that would never happen in Italy, ever. And yet there it was.
I don't think it did happen.
Lionel's special request to the kitchen was obviously listened to.
I mean, Napalm, the film Amarcord, which we've taken the inspiration for this feature, is kind of about the sort of lapsing consciousness that happened, which led to the Italians sort of embracing fascism. And I think you've had a bit of a lapse in either concentration or or conscience or consciousness to think that that actually happened in Bologna this time last year. No way.
I've got photographic evidence. I've got a photographic evidence. Wow. I may enter it in the little competition for favourite Italian dishes.
This reminds me, Napalm, I've already tried to get you to watch this on numerous occasions, but that reminds me of the Stanley Tucci film, Big Night, that if people are looking for a film to watch over the next couple of weeks, that will foreshadow a lot of conversations that we have about food, I think, over the course of the next 3 weeks.
That was quite a big night, I recall, in Bologna, and partly because we had to park so far away and then walk about half an hour to the restaurant. Do you remember that? Anyway, happy memories.
And that was our restaurateur for the evening, if I haven't already said that, that we heard from there.
Yeah, yeah, he was quite a character, wasn't he? We will be playing a memory from previous Giri every night. What's coming up in tomorrow's episode then, chaps?
Well, it's another stage, another Hungarian stage. We've decided to honour the 3 day, the triumvirate in Hungary that the Giro was going to go with. But we've got to change of route. Rich, I could tell yesterday how enthusiastic about the wine you were. And I can tell this is going to be a real epiphany, a game changer for you, this Giro. You're going to come out of this as a real connoisseur. So I thought I would take us to the most famous wine growing region of Hungary, Tokaj. Tokaj is a sweet wine predominantly. We're going there, we're going to the town itself, Tokaj, and we're going via another wine producing region. Our wine of the day will come from the Eger region.
And we're going to be talking about the classic cycling film Stars and Water Carriers, which follows the 1973 Giro d'Italia. And it was directed by Jørgen Leth, the Danish film director. I've had the Danish pronunciation police onto me already. It's Leth, not Leth, apparently. So we've got an interview with Jørgen Leth, and you'll hear that in tomorrow's episode.
And you can watch Stars and Water Carriers. It's on YouTube. And if you want to watch it before you listen to us talk about it, do so. And if you're wondering about any of the other things that we've mentioned in the podcast, such as how to get hold of the case of wine, how to ride our Giro, any of the, you know, over the course of the race, any of the books or films or races we mentioned, we will post as many links as we can in the show notes. So always check out the show notes if there's something that catches your ear.
And if anyone hasn't yet got hold of the wine from Divine Says, or if, like Richard, you've already drunk it ahead of time, then tomorrow's wine will be a Shiraz, a Syrah. If you can't get the exact right one, get any kind of Shiraz you can get your hands on.
In the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you.